This is The Guardian.
Enjoying this podcast? Then we think you might love the audio long read. The podcast of The Guardian Long Read, showcasing the best long-form journalism, with episodes about everything from the rise of ADHD to the double life of an alleged Russian spy. The Long Read offers great stories and big ideas. Follow the audio long read wherever you get your podcasts.
Слава нашим захисникам, слава нашим захисницям, слава Україні.
We are with you. Not just today or tomorrow, but for 100 years, long after this terrible war is over.
Putin shows no desire to negotiate at all, so we continue to support you to the max.
I'm Pippa Carrera.
And I'm Kieran Stacey.
You're listening to Politics Weekly Westminster for The Guardian. Hello.
Pippa, welcome back to Westminster.
Thank you.
It's a Thursday. We're not normally in the broom cupboard on a Thursday, but we're here for a very special podcast today. Tell us where you've just been and where you got back from this morning.
I arrived back from a couple of days in Ukraine this morning. I travelled to Kyiv with the Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, for a series of meetings with Volodymyr Zelensky and officials from his government.
Wow. Is this the first time you've ever been?
It's the first time I've been, yeah. Which is feel in itself is a bit weird because inevitably, I've written quite a lot about the conflict and British support for Ukraine, visiting politicians, all that sort of thing. You know, it's such a huge news story here in the UK. And yet, having never been, there was always felt there was that bit of it that was missing. So it was really, really fascinating to go and meet some of those people and see it myself up close.
So is this something you were pushing the Foreign Secretary to let you do?
Mentioned that I would be interested in doing it.
How did it come about?
And as luck happens, he was due a trip out around now. Obviously, it's a really key moment with both the change in administration in the United States and sort of the uncertainty around that and what that might mean for Ukraine. But also, we're coming up to 3 years of the most recent invasion. Obviously, there's Crimea incursion in 2014, but the sort of the most recent stage of the war. I think he wanted to go to underline Britain's commitment and support to Ukraine during the conflict going forward.
And presumably, you don't just go to Stansted and get on a flight to Kyiv, right? I mean, this is
sadly not. You can't just
challenge.
Yeah, you can't just fly there directly because obviously it would be potentially very dangerous with Russian anti-aircraft weaponry and so on. So what you do is you fly to either Poland or Moldova. I flew to Poland, and then you travel by land. And lots of people, some of our journalistic colleagues, would travel by car, going all the way across Ukraine to Kyiv and then further on to the front line in the east. But we travel by train. So it was an overnight train there and an overnight train back. I had a wee compartment to myself. There was a very nice conductor who appeared at regular intervals with bottles of water and bags of various Ukrainian pastries to keep me going.
Lots of carbs.
Lots of carbs. Fuel the journey. Didn't sleep massively well, but that was really the sort of, you know, the last thing on my mind. It wasn't about my sleep. It was more about what I was going to see. And I guess I was probably feeling a bit apprehensive about it too.
Right. Well, I mean, does it feel like you're entering a war zone when you're on this train? Are you kind of nervous? Are you conscious of what's going on around you?
Not really, beyond the fact that we all know that obviously Ukraine has been caught up in this conflict. And the first sort of signs, bearing in mind I was travelling through the night, the first signs I got were when you arrive in Kyiv, there's lots of graffiti, as there is in cities all around the world, along the side of the railway. And there was a few signs saying, you know, end war and free Ukraine and those sorts of things in English. I obviously can't read the Cyrillic Ukrainian script, so I couldn't work out what they were saying. Mm-hmm. And then in Kyiv itself, it's as many people remark, it feels in some ways very ordinary. It's like a big Eastern European capital with a very beautiful historic heart, which is much more, you know, sort of reminiscent of somewhere like Vienna, cobbled streets and big churches with huge domes. And then sort of like the much more probably standards in most people's minds, Eastern European city around it with big blocks, lots of sort of housing on the outskirts, and very little sign of the fact that they're in the middle of a war, apart from a lot of people on the street were wearing fatigues of one sort or another, military wear. And also, you would periodically come across a building which had been hit directly by a Russian drone or a missile and was boarded up. Or it was fenced off so you couldn't get anywhere near it. And there was actually one building right around the corner from the president's office that was hit on the 1st of January, a very beautiful, huge apartment block. And as of the top floor was all rubble and there was twisted metal of the car down below. And it's sort of those moments that remind you that you are, that even though we were hundreds of miles from the front line, that, that Ukrainian people are living that war every single day in all sorts of different ways. Most notably, of course, sending their sons, husbands, fathers, and it's not just men, women too, to the front line to fight. And that's something that they carry with them the whole time.
And what's it like for politicians as senior as the foreign secretary? Do they also have to sleep in a rickety cabin and dress up in combat fatigues, or do they, are they treated like royalty as they enter Ukraine?
I unsurprisingly didn't see the inside of the foreign secretary's cabin. I think it was a bit posher than mine, but fair enough. I think that's allowed. But he also travelled on the train. They were all there in their suits.
Right.
You know, there wasn't any sort of camo jackets or anything like that.
Wasted opportunity,
wasted
David
opportunity.
Lammy.
I know. Although we did go and see some anti-aircraft weapons and, you know, he met the army as well as the politicians.
And we've actually got a bit of that journey here. Let's hear a bit of you on your way into Ukraine.
I'm just pulling into Kyiv after 10 hours on the overnight train from Poland, sitting in a pretty cosy two-berth cabin and looking out the window as we pull through the train yards with the buildings of Kyiv beyond. There's snow on the ground. It's my first visit here and much of it looks exactly like I'd expected. Large concrete blocks and pylons, not many trees within the outskirts of the city, and in the distance I can just catch a glimpse of the central train station that we're pulling into. Of course, Kyiv is many hundreds of miles from any sort of front line in eastern Ukraine, and yet it's a city that we've heard and seen so much about, filled with people who are all feeling a direct impact of the war, not least because everybody knows somebody who is fighting or has been fighting in the conflict against Russia. I've just been at Volodymyr Zelensky's office, where we walked past piles of sandbags and tight security at the heavily guarded entrance to get to the meeting between David Lammy and the Ukrainian president. Zelensky arrived wearing his trademark black fleece and khaki cargo trousers. He said hi to us as he came in. It was quite a moment being in the same room as him, really. And he took a seat at this white wooden lacquered table in this very grand room, and he was flanked by Ukrainian flags. He started by thanking the UK for its support, and Lammy in return said that Britain would stand beside Ukraine to the end of its fight against the tyranny of Putin.
So that was you in Ukraine. And then on the journey back, you got some time with the foreign secretary himself, right? Set us up. Were you in the country? Were you travelling home? And what did you want to talk to him about?
Yeah, I was travelling back and I wanted to ask him about the trip, why he'd gone, and what he'd learnt when he was there. He's been to Ukraine 5 or 6 times before, both the shadow foreign secretary and as foreign secretary. Obviously, Keir Starmer was there a couple of weeks ago as well. So this is, I think they were trying to underline Britain's commitment to Zelensky's cause, to Ukraine's cause, to the fight against, as he put it, the tyranny of the Russians.
Okay, well, let's hear a bit of that interview now.
David, you met Volodymyr Zelensky and senior government officials, and you talked a lot about it being a crucial moment for Ukraine and a crucial moment to visit. Why was that?
It's a crucial moment on land. This is a war of attrition. It's now been going on for almost 3 years. Ukrainian soldiers have had little break. Of course, Putin thought this war would be over in a matter of weeks, but he has made some gains on the ground in the last few months. And it's a crucial moment because, of course, there's a change of administration in the United States. Understandably, they're looking again at this crisis. And of course, that makes all partners anxious and concerned for the future. So I recognise it's a crucial moment. And as Ukraine's leading international partner, we've been there right from the beginning. It's always been a cross-party position in the UK. It was right for the Prime Minister to visit a couple of weeks ago, and I'm following up on that visit, and I sensed that that was very welcome.
Yes, I mean, certainly, well, from what we saw, I was lucky enough to be at the beginning of some of those meetings that you had, and there was sort of a very warm welcome extended to you being there. But how realistic do you think it is that we'll get peace talks in the coming weeks, and could we see an end to fighting anytime soon?
I mean, personally, I'm not sure we are weeks away from peace talks. And I say that because our assessment, which I'm quite sure that the United States share, is that Putin shows absolutely no appetite for negotiation and to bring this war to an end. So I'm not sure that we are weeks away, but clearly all of us want this war to end. And as we speak here at the beginning of February, we are still very much in the depths of winter. We sense that, of course, when we were there, it was snowing, ice on the ground. And the truth is, the young men and women that make up the 800,000 Ukrainian force are fighting for their country's future on the ground, and that will go on for a number of months, I suspect. Mm.
And beyond continuing to provide our steadfast support, to use your words, I think, and also the very large military contribution that we make to Ukraine, how else will we play our part in bringing that conflict to an end?
Oh, look, we have, with the United States, a tremendous intelligence capability, of course. We continue to support Ukraine in all efforts, humanitarian efforts and economic efforts, of course. And that must and will continue.
And bricks on the ground?
And then when the peace comes, of course, we will be alongside Ukraine helping to negotiate that peace. There is a discussion about the sort of security guarantees that would be necessary. I suspect that discussion will run for some months yet. That involves many European partners and G7 partners, and so it's premature really to over-anticipate what the UK contribution might be.
You've met Volodymyr Zelensky several times now. How did he seem to you? He looked pretty knackered to me.
Well, I've met him now on, I think, probably four or five occasions. This is a wartime leader. You're always hugely conscious of that when you're meeting him, weighing military planning, the loss of life, holding his nation together and dealing with an array of international partners. And it's obviously amazing that he's now been doing that job, not just for the last few years since the intensification of war in February 2022, but actually as a leader for 6 years, remembering that Ukraine has been in crisis since 2014. Actually, he appeared to me to be upbeat, despite the tiredness, no doubt, in the job, relatively upbeat. Now, that may be because he was meeting with the UK, who are major partners. He saw, obviously, the Prime Minister just a few weeks ago. He'd been in London. We signed the 100-year partnership. Two countries can't be more close than we in Ukraine are at the moment.
And how about you? We've just got off is it a 10-hour train ride? Did you sleep at all? In your luxury presidential suite?
Well,
not luxury, I should say.
You know, I've actually got a very bad back, which is not conducive in some ways to being Foreign Secretary, because it does mean that you are doing night flights, night trains. I sort of, whenever I do that night train journey, it's a sort of 10-hour journey through Poland into Ukraine, I always sort of think I am looking forward one day to doing this journey, not going to a war zone, doing it and looking out the window and enjoying, you know, one of Europe's great train journeys. And I'm very, very conscious too, you know, there are on the foreign policy circuit, if you like, and amongst foreign ministers, there are sort of different periods that you reflect on. And I've spoken to older colleagues who lived through the Bosnia War and were dealing with that crisis. So I've got colleagues who lived through the Iraq war and were dealing with that crisis and the counter-terrorism that flowed from that. This generation is very much living through the Ukraine war. Many of us have made that journey. And what it brings to mind, of course, is war in Europe, the changing defence and security picture in Europe, and of course echoes of conflict in Europe going back to the Second World War. And I suppose so. That's what it makes me conscious of now, having done it many times. And obviously when I'm speaking to G7 partners, all of whom have made that journey, you cannot fly into Kyiv. One day you will again, but at the moment it's that journey.
I think it's a hope we all share. David Lammy, thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you.
Right, well, there's plenty to discuss there. We'll get stuck into that in just a moment. Okay, Pippa, that was fascinating. What did you take away from that conversation?
Well, there was a lot there. And I think the thing that really stood out to me was the timing. As I said, it was 3 years since the initial invasion. And it was also at a time when there's a huge amount of uncertainty about what the US will do and its continued commitment to Ukraine. As one senior Foreign Office official said to me when I asked them what they thought Donald Trump's plans were, they replied that they thought it was a mystery, not a secret. So nobody quite knows, perhaps including the Americans. Although I think we're going to hear more from Keith Kellogg, who's the who's Trump's envoy to Ukraine, at the Munich Security Conference coming up. So I think the timing was really important. And I think one thing which really came out to me when we were there, and which David Lammy mentioned just now in this in the interview, was the cross-party support for Ukraine that exists in the UK. What we've seen is that when administrations change, individual countries' direction and approach to Ukraine can change quite dramatically. So we saw that in the States. The relationship had kind of cooled a bit with Joe Biden. He was holding back on allowing long-range missiles and so on. And then there was sort of like a last-minute flurry of activity just before he stepped down. And we've seen it also with Germany and Scholz and his approach to Ukraine as well. And the one thing that Britain's been able to do, and which clearly Zelensky and his team really appreciate, is that whether this country is led by the Conservatives or, as it now is, by the Labour Party, they're both committed to all the different ways that we're supporting Ukraine. And that's obviously economically, that's obviously through humanitarian means, but crucially militarily. And we're giving £3 billion of military support a year going forward. So it's also, it's not just the sort of the commitment now, it's the commitment going forward. And when Keir Starmer was over, he talked about this 100-year agreement, which struck us all as being a bit over the top, but apparently it was Ukraine's suggestion and they wanted to have that sort of time frame on it because it suggested that it was into perpetuity. It was for the next generation and the generation and the generation after that, which kind of makes it all make a little bit more sense. And so it's the constancy of that relationship, but also the fact that the UK is in a position where right from the start has been leading others and encouraging others, whether that's European allies or the States, to do more. And I think the Ukrainians recognise that Britain has had that role and are grateful that they'll continue to have that role. And that's what partly what the trip is about.
And you talk about the timing, obviously pretty significant given that the Trump administration has just come in and Donald Trump has talked about getting a peace deal signed on day one. I thought it was very telling in your interview that David Lammy said, well, it's not even going to be weeks before we start to talk about a ceasefire. Is he sending a message there to Washington, do you think?
I think he's warning all of us that there's not going to be an imminent end to fighting. And I think when Donald Trump came in and said, I'm going to solve the Ukraine crisis on day one, and then very quickly realised that it actually was going to take him 6 months, and I don't know what the time frame now is, there's been a recognition in the US administration that this is much more complicated than it may have appeared at first sight. And I think what Lammy's trying to do is manage expectations, because Vladimir Putin has actually been quite open about what he wants to settle. And he's set out his red lines, which include things like keeping territory that they've already occupied, that what he calls the denazification of Ukraine, which basically means a new government, getting rid of Zelensky. And then he's talked about a commitment to Ukraine never joining NATO, which for him is the big one. And so we know what he wants, but none of those are possibilities for Ukraine. So Zelensky can't negotiate with himself. So I think what the West is waiting for is for Putin to budge. And that, I think, will dictate the timing. And the factors which could potentially make Putin budge are the numbers of people that have been lost. I mean, he's on his third army, having gone through the professional army and then conscript army and now on volunteers. The second thing is the Russian economy and the impacts of inflation, the fact that he's taken some decisions himself about the Russian central bank as well. That all unsettles the Russian economy, not yet at a point where it's tipping point, but he's approaching that cliff edge. And the third thing is weaponry and their ability to develop weapons and correspondingly Ukraine's ability to either develop weapons or use weapons developed by their partners. And those are the three areas which could push Putin a little bit further. And I think what Lamy is basically suggesting is that none of those things are going to change very quickly. And so we need to be aware that, that there's not necessarily going to be an end to fighting anytime soon, that Putin will talk, but talking isn't a negotiation.
One of the things that Zelensky is really good at is using these occasions to make quite specific demands. I remember when he came here to Westminster to talk at Westminster Hall, and I think he was asking for fighter jets at the time, and he came with a fighter jet helmet, which he kind of brandished with. It was a great piece of political theatre. Did you get the sense that there was any specific demand that Ukrainians had of the UK?
I think they want to the UK to put pressure on the US to be part of what Zelensky calls the security guarantees, so that should they reach a position where there is an end to the fighting, they don't want it to be a temporary end to the fighting. And in 3 years' time, Putin just invades again and, you know, we go back to where we were. It has to be a sustainable peace. And Donald Trump's talked a lot about peace through strength. So there's been a lot of discussion about what that actually means. Your ultimate aim is peace. Does that mean that you sort of go with the strength bit now? Do you continue supporting Ukraine? Do you have US troops on the ground? And the one thing that it's clear, over and above things like NATO, you know, long-term aspirations for Zelensky that he really wants, is the US to commit to the security guarantees. And that potentially means having a monitoring force on the ground. Now, the border between Russia and Ukraine is thousands of miles long. And so that's a big ask. And when we were there, I don't know what he said in the private meeting, but he came out of the private meeting with Lamy and spoke to the Ukrainian press. And he basically said, Europeans alone, and including UK force alone, is not enough. That he needs the US to have a shared responsibility in the security guarantees. And he said that it would be a serious mistake for the United States not to get involved, because that's what Russia wants. And it would give Moscow strategic and political advantage. So his big ask at the moment is for a US commitment to the security guarantees to make sure that that peace is lasting.
That doesn't have to be boots on the ground, presumably.
It doesn't have to be boots on the ground. There are all sorts of other ways that the US could provide those security guarantees. And I mean, NATO membership is one, obviously, that I mentioned, and I think that's not looking likely anytime soon. There are all sorts of different ways that they could do that. And that's the sort of thing they'd have to thrash out. But what he needs from Donald Trump is a commitment to taking part and sharing responsibility in that. If Europe ends up in a position where it is not just potentially militarily under threat, I mean, Zelensky was warning yesterday that Russia might head to the Baltics and Eastern Europe next, but is also economically unstable, then that has a direct impact as one of the world's biggest trading blocs on the United States. So I think he feels that he can, David Lammy feels that he can have a role in persuading the new US administration that helping Ukraine is not just good for the rest of the world, it's also good for America.
Did David Lammy give you any sense of what the UK commitment to this lasting peace might be? We're led to believe by reports that officials are definitely looking at having troops on that border, British troops on that border. Did he talk about that at all?
So I asked him about Keir Starmer's commitment to playing our full part in securing that peace. If it comes, when it comes, let's try and be optimistic about it. Obviously, Keir Starmer's response was to a direct question about having troops on the ground. And he didn't confirm that, but he didn't deny it either. I think he's thinking more broadly. I think he's thinking that there are all sorts of other ways beyond having a presence there. What was very clear to me throughout is that Britain will be playing a role, and not just a peripheral one, a big one. We're in this for the long term.
And what about Zelensky himself? I mean, this is the first time, I guess, you've been up close and personal with him. How does he seem? Does he look like he's up for the fight? Is he starting to look a little bit battle-weary? What was your takeaway?
Well, my immediate impression was that he's earned his reputation for being a good communicator. I mean, he came in and he chatted to us, said hi,
Even to the lowly journalists.
And we were sort of like silent, sort of stunned that he was actually talking to us. And he says, silence, that's not like you lot. And talking in English as well. And then obviously sat down and got down to the serious business. I thought he looked knackered. But then when I made that point to David Lammy, he was kind of like, well, you know, of course he's a war leader. Yeah. And actually he felt that having met him, you know, half a dozen times, that he was actually quite energized. Okay. And I guess maybe sees this moment as an opportunity because there are so many moving parts. But it was amazing actually being in the room with him, and it really does humanize what he and Ukraine's leaders are going through for their people.
Well, look, thanks for discussing that with us. We're going to have a lot more from your interview on our website and in the paper,
that's
right?
That's right. Yeah, there's lots of, we talked about all sorts of other stuff, which I'll be reporting on. So do check out The Guardian's website or pick up a copy of the paper.
Great. And regular listeners might notice that we've done two of these special episodes this week, and we're hoping we might have more in the future. So keep tuning in. Please like and follow Politics Weekly UK to make sure you keep getting our episodes in your feed. We'll be back with a regular episode on Monday. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby, music by Axel Cucoutier, and the executive producer is Zoe Hitch. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
This is The Guardian.
Enjoying this podcast? Then we think you might love the audio long read, the podcast of The Guardian Long Read, with episodes about caffeine addiction, the secret life of saints, and Britain's strangest pub chain. The Long Read offers great stories and big ideas. Follow the audio long read wherever you get your podcasts.